Hello, good morning, and welcome. It's Tuesday, the 16th of June, 2020, and we're back with episode 156. And we've got another great guest today. This time it's Dmitry Shevelenko, the founder and president of Tortoise, an autonomous e-mobility startup in Silicon Valley. And when I say autonomous e-mobility startup, what I mean is autonomous e-scooter startup. Yeah, they've actually developed kit which enables, not strictly speaking, autonomous e-scooters, but to be precise, the remote or teleoperation of these e-scooters. The idea being that when you try to get a scooter to go for a ride, for instance, think of your Lime or Bird scooters, instead of having to locate them and then walk to them, you can press a button and, of course, these things will then, well, scoot on over to you. And similarly, when you park your scooter at the end of the ride, well, these will then scoot off to a designated parking spot to help kind of alleviate the big problem around the world of these things just kind of ending up as little more than sidewalk litter. But anyway, we'll dive into all this and much more in just a little bit. Before getting started, though, just a friendly reminder, if you're a fan of this podcast, please don't forget to follow me on all, well, on whatever is your favorite podcast platform, but especially Apple Podcasts. Please do drop me 5 stars there if you're a fan, and preferably a written review. If you haven't yet taken our international survey on consumer acceptance of autonomous car tech generally, please do be sure to head on over to hogandco.com. That's HOAGANDCO. Click the blue banner at the top and take the survey. Finally, one other thing really worth mentioning. I know I've shared in the past that my wife and I did place an order for our Tesla Model Y. And I'm pretty thrilled to announce that we finally just got news that we've got our VIN. Yeah, the actual vehicle is finally built. We placed this order back in February, specifically on Valentine's Day. So we are pretty thrilled indeed. And having called the Fremont Delivery Center, my understanding is that we should be able to take delivery of this thing in possibly the next couple of days, certainly within the week or so, to pick it up somewhere in San Francisco. So we are super excited. But the reason I'm telling you this is because, if you remember, about a year ago, I had the chance to make a somewhat tongue-in-cheek, somewhat ridiculous video of Tesla Model 3's autopilot system. So, needless to say, I am very excited to eventually go ahead and make a video of our new Model Y as soon as we've got it. If you're interested, don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. You can find it by searching for, well, just a Autonomous Hogue, actually. That will get you there. The actual URL is, it's a bit of a mouthful. It's a bit long. It's youtube.com/autonomouscarswithmarkhogue. Yeah. But go ahead and give it a search. If you haven't yet seen last year's video, give it a watch. I think you'll get a kick out of it. It is pretty ridiculous, just to warn you. But yeah, if you subscribe, you'll be notified as soon as my new Model Y video goes live. I don't know when I'm going to do it. With any luck, I should have this thing published before the end of the month, possibly. We shall see. Right. Anyway, enough about that. Let's dive in and get started. Hope you're sitting comfortably. We've got about an hour once again, this time with Dmitry Shevelenko, the founder and president of Tortoise. All this right now.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
3, 2, 1, and we're live. So, Dmitry, awesome to chat finally. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, in quarantine life, you know, this is as good a social interaction as you can get. So it's great to have the conversation.
Seriously, yeah. And hey, let's look at the bright side. What else are people going to do but listen to awesome podcasts? Am I right? So let's see here. Look, obviously, I read about you guys. Well, you and I think first connected, I think through LinkedIn somehow a while back, if I'm not mistaken. And then coincidentally, I read a bunch of cool articles about what you were up to, and I should say in conjunction with some partner companies you're already working with. But as usual, I like to kind of start from the top, learn a bit about you kind of personally, your background, kind of how you ended up in this gig, because frankly, I think I speak for all of us who've learned about Tortoise. It's kind of hard not to picture a swarm or a herd or what is it, a flock of scooters flying about autonomously. I don't even know what noun to use. So how'd you get into this mess anyway?
Yeah, so I've been around Silicon Valley for a while. Was at Facebook out of college and was with the company as it went from 80 million users to 800 million users. And so got a taste of what hypergrowth feels like and have been addicted to it ever since. Joined Uber in 2014 and helped lead the company's expansion into new mobility, which included the jump bikes and scooters, things like Uber Transit, Uber car rentals. And one of the reasons I was very bullish about micromobility is I saw the internal data that more than 50% of rideshare trips are under 2 miles, 60% of all private car trips are under 3 miles. And now that we're in an era where you can manufacture a light electric vehicle for $500 to $1,000, and it can be a faster, more enjoyable way to do those short trips, it felt like an inevitable solution to urban congestion and really this real estate and geometry problem. And we have more and more people moving into cities and cars take up a lot of space. And so how do you move this growing numbers of people through the same space? And one of the obvious answers is having smaller vehicles. And so after a great 4-year run at Uber, I spent a stretch advising a bunch of different mobility companies, ranging from scooter operators to scooter manufacturers to companies like Remix that sell software to cities to help them manage all these new mobility modes. And through these experiences, saw what was working well in shared micromobility, but also saw some of the big challenges. And you have a very unreliable rider experience. 9 times out of 10, when you want to find a scooter, you need to go on a wild goose chase to find it. You have an upside down business model for the operators. They're all losing a lot of money. And then you have some gnarly public nuisance issues with scooter sidewalk clutter and obstruction. And long story short, I, during this period, met my now co-founder, David Graham, who was at the time building an autonomous lawnmower. And he realized that if you're working with a light electric vehicle that weighs under 200 pounds and you don't need to move it faster than 5 miles per hour, and you can have a solution that's hybrid autonomy and then using a remote teleoperator, so a remote driver who's able to see out of the cameras on it, it only takes $100 in electronics to take that light electric vehicle and make it capable of what we call remote or automated repositioning. And as exciting as the lawnmower space was, we quickly realized that you apply that same technology to a shared scooter and you can solve those three big challenges I addressed. So you can now have this on-demand experience for a rider where you can just press a button on your phone and instead of an Uber or Lyft showing up, a scooter shows up at your front door. You can get the right scooter to the right place at the right time, significantly increasing the revenue per day per scooter. You can dramatically reduce the labor costs of recharging them. And you can repark a scooter immediately after a rider completes their trip. And so we saw this really unique opportunity to be an essential service for a very fast-growing market. But what got us even more excited is realizing there's going to be a bunch of different new light electric vehicles, whether they be delivery robots, security robots, cleaning robots, they're all going to need this ability to get from A to B cost effectively. And that was the origin of Tortoise. And we first conquered solving this in the scooter space. We launched our first deployments and are making a lot of great progress there. But with everything that's happened with COVID and this boom in e-commerce, we're also really excited about applying this technology to delivery and last mile logistics. And we're just getting started, but very excited to be making it possible to move things cost effectively across the city.
Yeah, totally. No, I mean, but with respect to COVID, I would assume that this would actually be kind of an optimal time for what you guys are doing, right? Whether it's with respect to the scooters or, as you just mentioned, branching out into the delivery space too. No, I mean,
yeah, I mean, generally, yes, I would say, and I'm the biggest cheerleader of all things mobility, but with COVID, you do have a freeze in the movement of people. And so the overall TAM, if you will, of moving people has contracted a little bit. But it certainly, in terms of if you are running shared micromobility operations, it's even more important to make it profitable now than it was 6 months ago. It's even more important to be able to actually disinfect the vehicles throughout the day. And that's one of the things you can do if you have this real-time rebalancing ability, is get them to a place where they can be cleaned more frequently. I think the other really exciting opportunity for anybody who's bullish on the future of cities without cars dominating them is there's been something like 2,500 miles of road space that's been reallocated from cars back to bike lanes and pedestrians. And that type of infrastructure shift would have otherwise taken 5, maybe 10 years. This is certainly there's reasons to be optimistic, but there's also fewer people making trips. And so that certainly, you know, all the operators saw a significant decline in usage. But if you look at the data now out of China, Korea, Paris, bike share and scooter share utilization is the highest it's ever been. Now, unfortunately, some of that is coming from people being afraid to take public transit. And so public transit is still hurting a lot.
And that's an alarming thing, though, right? Because the idea of so many people starting to go back to work, starting to commute, and suddenly abandoning public transit if they can, if they have their own cars, that's a pretty kind of scary idea, too. I mean, if we thought traffic was bad before, it's going to be catastrophic now, right?
Yeah, I mean, even if 5% of the people that otherwise were taking public transit start driving themselves, absolutely catastrophic in terms of congestion being way worse than it ever was before COVID. I think that's why, though, it's, you know, cities are making these investments into making micromobility more accessible and safer with these dedicated lanes, because we can't just solve the problem with cars. And there's, you know, there's a two-way street here in the sense that if you take space away from cars, you are going to make congestion worse to some point. But you actually have to, I think, to change behavior, people need to feel that a bike or scooter trip is going to be faster and more efficient than a car trip. And I think that's and obviously as safe. But once you do that, you know, once people go scooter or bike, they don't really go back. And so it's exciting to see some of these behavior shifts happening.
Yeah, but I guess the corollary to that is obviously it's true. If you reduce, if you reduce lanes for traffic, sure, you produce a brief inefficiency, I suppose. But obviously, adding lanes also eventually results in the same inefficiency as before you added the lane. So I think it's kind of a wash in a way, right? I mean,
yeah, it's just that there's going to be a constituency that is going to be, hey, you know, traffic is already bad, like. Yep. Yeah. Why aren't we giving more space to cars? And, you know, cities are going to require political courage to toe the line and kind of drive this behavior shift towards these more sustainable modes. Because, you know, there's more dollars at stake in terms of the built-in constituency for promoting cars versus these new modes. So it's going to take political courage. But I don't think there's ever been a better opportunity to drive this behavior shift. You know, the classic, never let a crisis go to waste. COVID.
Right. Well, so that's kind of my point. Yeah, that's my point actually, is COVID. Exactly. So looking, for example, in Oakland, didn't they shut down like 75 miles worth of road? And even before COVID, Market Street in SF finally got shut down to at least most vehicle traffic. The thing that I'm wondering is, you know, and it's not just Oakland, 75 miles of road, but we saw this happen in, I guess it was Milan and Rome, and I think, you know, elsewhere throughout the world. I wonder, I hope these changes end up being permanent, right? Because that's kind of the concern. You've got this great kind of testing ground now with all this kind of disused road space, well, disused for vehicles anyway, road space. And then, so yeah, start testing whether it's scooters or indeed even delivery robots or full autonomous vehicles of any sort. But I guess the question is, will we start to realize that, oh, this is actually pretty neat. This actually kind of works. Even here in the town that we live in, here in Marin County, there's talks now, if you know the area at all, you know, Tiburon, they talk about closing down their little main street to closing it down to, you know, shutting off cars entirely, just making it open for pedestrians and outdoor cafes. And I'm thinking, gosh, you mean like so many European cities have done, or towns have done forever? I mean, my hope is that this trial phase ends up kind of sticking. People realize it works.
Well, the nice thing is infrastructure has a incumbency bias. So it's really hard to change it. But once it's changed, it's actually really hard to change it back. So I think that's, you know, what has otherwise kind of bedeviled advocates of making these changes. You know, again, we have this crisis opportunity where you know, an aggregate, some thousands of miles have been reallocated. It's going to be tough to unwind that. And you have to make a new set of arguments of why you should give it back to cars. And there's also a safety aspect to this. You know, the Vision Zero advocates, they've been pushing for these types of changes as a solution for a long time. And I do think we'll see a reduction in fatalities, pedestrian fatalities, cycling fatalities as a result of these changes. And I think that becomes an even stronger set of arguments to keep these positive changes in place.
And what do you think about sort of a hybrid solution where more and more roads start to open up again to cars, but you do set aside some dedicated lanes or even indeed some entire dedicated roads just for, well, in this case, scooters or even for, well, autonomous vehicles as well. Again, the analogy I've often used is that in a sense, at least with respect to autonomous cars, these are effectively sort of trains, virtual trains, right? And you look at certain of the great cities in the world where this works so well. I mean, one that comes to mind is in Zurich, there's a main street there called Bahnhofstrasse. It's basically, it's essentially like a street tram road and pedestrians. Some cars can drive on it, but basically it's not that common, right? And that works really, really well. That would make sense here though, right? Just to have some dedicated areas just for the scooters.
Yeah. I think the easiest way to implement these policies is to take two lanes of road and turn it into a one-way street and reallocate one of those lanes. You know, in some cases, I mean, my take on autonomous vehicles, and when I say autonomous vehicle, that's, you know, anything that's weighs more than 1,000 pounds, so not really putting scooters and robots in that category. But I'm very bearish in terms of the market readiness of autonomous vehicles that have to interact with human drivers. But if you have completely dedicated lanes,
don't let them interact.
Exactly. Like you said, it's like a train. That's the way we start being able to take advantage of those technologies in our cities. And I think, you know, the analogy of kind of bus rapid transit and bringing automation into those types of roadways, I feel like that those are the productive paths to take these conversations. But I think that, you know, there's downsides to completely getting rid of cars in terms of, you know, some things that you try to get delivered. If there's no car access to a certain house, even from one side of the street, it creates challenges, right? And so I don't think you want to reduce the livability of cities. I don't think the right solution for every street is to completely shut it down to cars. But having wide, you know, wide berths for pedestrians, for scooters, for bikes, you know, preserving car space, but not necessarily making it as efficient as it was before. I think that's where you start seeing some really easy to implement solutions.
Have you seen what they've done in DC in the last couple of years?
What specifically?
Like with respect to lanes, they've done a really, because I was there a year ago and I was just super impressed. They've done a really great job building out a bunch of dedicated bike lanes. And when I say dedicated, I don't just mean like, oh, here's a green portion of the side of the road and that's it. I mean, like they've shifted the parallel parking spots away from the curb to effectively create a buffer between the moving vehicle traffic and the bike lane, which is now up against the curb. That is just, I mean, I've seen it elsewhere before outside of the US. I had never seen it in the US until in DC a year ago. And I just thought, wow, this is so cool. This is great. Like, why is SF not doing this yet? You know?
I think they have started. So on Howard Street in San Francisco, so, you know, Mayor London Breed has actually been fantastic in terms of building out bike lanes. But yeah, there are effectively using the parallel parking lane as a buffer for the bike lane is.
Oh, they are doing this. Oh, I didn't know they were doing that yet. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so they've just started. I think it was in the last year. But yeah, it's one of those duh things. Yeah. You see it, you're like, why did we ever do it a different way?
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember, you know, you go back 5 years ago, the cyclist community was a fairly, in many cities, it was a niche. It wasn't, there wasn't kind of this mass desire to see biking be prevalent. And I think electrification has actually, and having a lot of these shared products like shared scooters, shared bikes, it's helped expand the constituency of folks that care about bike lanes. Not just people who are, you know, have very fancy bikes or you know, into cycling as a community, but people who just use it as a very effective mode of transportation. And so, you know, I think I have a hard time imagining all of this progress on the infrastructure side happening if these shared operators hadn't scaled the way they had and introduced so many people to biking, to scooters that otherwise would have only really, you know, thought about biking as a recreational activity. You know, you drive to a park on the weekend specifically to bike as opposed to a mode of transportation.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle, a run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
But you're right, though. It does have to be a really proactive intent to make this reality happen, right? So I read a thing recently that actually really surprised me. I didn't know this. You probably know this already. But it turns out that Amsterdam, which I guess is like the, you know, like the city for promoting bicycle riding, and I've always assumed it's just kind of been that way forever. It turns out that actually after World War II is really decidedly not such a pro bike friendly city. And it's kind of only changed after folks realized, hey, this isn't really working. And so there was a very, very, you know, proactive effort to make it be the bike friendly city that it is today, for instance. And I guess I say that with the point being, it's a bit surprising that it isn't such an intuitive thing, despite the fact that, as you say, once you get there, people are like, oh, this is pretty awesome. Why would I ever go back from this?
Well, I think part of the structural challenge is in the US and even in large parts of Europe, owning a car and using a car in a city or a suburb is heavily subsidized by the government. So
that's true. Yeah.
So you, and there is no, you know, the amount of subsidy per car is way greater than subsidy per bike or per pedestrian. And the, you know, to me, the best idea I've come across is this great urban planning book called Order Without Design. And it's really charging users of road space based off of the amount of space they're consuming. And what mode they're using and kind of the negative externalities of that. So, you know, you have this idea of congestion pricing, which is to charge people to enter a certain area during a certain time. But this almost takes it to the next level, which is really think of anytime you're on a public roadway, you're effectively renting that space And you have different rental rates depending on the mode of transportation. And that's how you're, if you adopt that type of policy, now that we have, you know, all the smartphone technology, we actually have the ability to administer and handle the accounting of something like that seamlessly. And it feels like that's how we put ourselves on a path where you could easily see how autonomous vehicles slot into this model as well. But that feels like we can correct some of the misallocation of subsidy and really encourage consumers to use the modes that have the least rental costs. Because when you're going 40 miles per hour in a 2,000-pound vehicle, it's not just the space you're taking up; it's the space ahead of you and in front of you that needs to be yours, so that nobody crashes into you, right? So the faster you're going and the larger the vehicle, the more space you need in between those vehicles. That's where autonomous vehicles have an advantage, because if it's a dedicated lane, you don't need to work in human reaction time. But otherwise, I think of it through the lens of real estate and geometry. Cars just take up a huge amount of space on the roadway when they're going 30 miles per hour. We need a right size for that with smart policies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Hey, that book you mentioned was Order Without Design, you said, right?
Yep.
Alan Bertrand. Okay. Yeah. It's funny. No, just the other day, I learned of another book that I've got to read called The Power Broker by Robert Caro. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah. The guy who basically made modern New York.
Embarrassingly, I only just learned about this. So I guess now I've got two books to read on my list. I guess the latter of which is rather large.
Yeah. Order Without Design, you might get through a little bit faster. It's
I think I'll start with that one. Cool. I keep wanting to come back to discuss your actual technology, and indeed kind of the recent news I've read about your partnership with, it's GoX Scooters. But what you said made me think of yet another tangent I wanted to ask you. You mentioned briefly about occupancy and this and that. I'm curious what you think the idea of an autonomous vehicle future, and I'm going to come right back to scooters in a moment, really kind of presupposes a shared future, right? The idea being that if you've got a bunch of empty pod cars buzzing about, well, this is obviously going to make traffic a lot worse, because of course. Is the solution as simple? Besides the fact that it also kind of presupposes moving away from any sort of car ownership at a private level, does it also suggest that you're going to have some sort of a tax, like an occupancy tax, right? So obviously, if it's an empty car, it's going to be taxed really heavily. If it's full, it's going to be a lot cheaper. Is that the only way to kind of make this happen?
I mean, the way I think of autonomous cars is we actually already have the business model for it in place, which is the ride-hail business model. And you kind of had UberX and Uber Pool. So I don't think you necessarily need to make it so every autonomous vehicle has to be an Uber Pool, but the customer that's using the UberX vehicle, there's just a higher tax rate for an autonomous UberX versus an autonomous Uber Pool. And that's how you kind of use that type of taxation to manage congestion. But I also, one of the reasons I'm somewhat I think it's going to be a while before we have scaled autonomous vehicles for passengers, is because it's the convenience of that business model is already here. You press a button, a car comes to you. It's going to be a long time before it's going to be significantly cheaper for that car to be autonomous and not have a driver versus what we have today. I mean, I was chatting with some folks at Uber ATG, and they were saying some of the internal estimates of when a autonomous car will both be cheaper and safer than a human driver is 2037. I think in many ways rideshare took the sales out of the need for autonomous vehicles, because the magical customer experience already exists today. A big part of why we're excited about Tortoise is we're trying to bring that same magical experience of press a button, a light electric vehicle comes to you that you can drive yourself, like a scooter or e-bike, that doesn't yet exist. And we can use accessible technologies like remote teleoperations that don't require R&D breakthroughs to start making that magic happen for riders.
Yeah. All right, cool. So let's indeed talk more than about exactly what you guys are doing and kind of how it works. I mean, I've got this looping GIF, and yes, I still say GIF, this looping GIF in front of my face of, yeah, I think I'm just going to go with swarm of scooters on this article over at, what is this anyway, CNET? Yeah, CNET's Roadshow from a couple weeks ago. So just to be clear then, these are indeed remotely operated, at least for the time being, presumably for testing, or is that kind of the...
Yes. I mean, not just for testing. I mean, we think that for the next 12 to 18 months, and whenever we first enter a market, to make sure the community understands what's happening, it's really valuable that people understand that there's always direct human accountability and human control of a scooter that's going by you at a low speed with nobody on it. And once we've entered a market, then we can start over time using more and more autonomy for parts of a repositioning. But when I think about crossing an intersection, when I think about interacting with pedestrians, even 5 years from now, I think we're going to be using remote drivers for that part of a repositioning. And so our view is getting something from A to B along a public right of way that includes sidewalk and crosswalk and road shoulder is always going to be a hybrid approach. There's certainly parts of that trip you're going to be able to use autonomy software on, but unless you're adding, you know, $20,000 in electronics and compute to a $500 scooter, you're not going to be able to convince a city official that it can handle all of the edge cases of what may happen crossing an intersection. And that's why, you know, both from a peace of mind point of view, a regulatory acceleration point of view, we think it's really important to have these technologies be hybrid and not to make the goalposts L5 autonomy for a scooter that's being repositioned.
Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, is the technology on the scooters right now today capable of doing that sort of autonomy and just it's not used, or what's the tech right now?
Yeah, so right now we can handle about 25% of a typical trip autonomously. Now we don't use that, and our goal when we deploy isn't to increase that percentage currently. Like we don't view our deployments as, you know, we're not trying to learn and kind of use our first cities as lab rats. We're trying to provide a valuable service. We think it's, again, our first priority is making the service incredibly reliable with teleoperations, having people accept it and see the value of it. And then over time, we can increase the autonomy percentage. One of the reasons we are able to take that approach is we've built a distributed teleoperation system out the gate. So we're able
that,
to...
That was my next question, actually.
Yeah, so we have... teleoperations center in Mexico. The way we've set up our teleoperations infrastructure, anybody anywhere in the world can be a teleoperator. So whether they be in India or Bangladesh, and we've made it so that the interface for the teleoperator, that the hardware they need is very minimal. So you could do it on a basic laptop with a decent internet connection, and that's it. And so being able to create really good earning opportunities for people in lower labor cost markets. We're already able to move a scooter across a U.S. or European city way more cost effectively than the next best alternative. And so we don't need to artificially rush the adoption of autonomy to start creating really powerful cost efficiencies for our customers.
Yeah. Okay. So that is exactly what I wanted to ask. So the idea is that you'd eventually, or I guess currently, it sounds like, effectively open this up so instead of a bunch of drivers who kind of decide to drive for Uber or Lyft, now you've got a bunch of folks who can remotely from the comfort of their home effectively take over and remote operate these scooters, right? So anybody can just kind of jump in and do that.
It's like a video game where you make money.
That's where I was going with this.
And that's again why our strategy is to be horizontal, right? So we're currently doing this for scooters. We're excited to be coming out with our own delivery cart that's purpose built for grocery, alcohol, retail orders that with COVID have now really, you know, just seen a dramatic increase in people needing last mile fulfillment. And from a teleoperator point of view, it doesn't matter whether you're driving a scooter or a delivery cart or a security bot or a cleaning bot, you're following a route and you're getting it to its destination. And the more teleoperators we have, the higher their utilization, the more efficient our system is. And so one way I describe Tortoise is we're an AWS for moving things in the real world, crossed with a Uber for teleoperations, where we're trying to aggregate the most demand for teleoperations. And when we say teleoperations, in our context, the one constraint is always low speed. And generally light mass vehicles. There's companies like Phantom Auto that are doing teleoperations for self-driving cars, a few other companies in that space. We're not touching that because you need way more than a basic laptop for that teleoperator. But if you're constraining yourself to low speed and then a light mass vehicle, that's where you can have this very minimal hardware requirement for the teleoperator.
And since you said you're doing kind of both scooters and then eventually delivery bots, droids, whatever we call them, I mean, am I correct in assuming then that whatever kit you've developed for these can be easily, effectively, retrofitted for any other sort of device in that form factor? Or potentially you've now got this partnership, I guess, with GoX. I'm assuming this is a thing that can work with just about anybody else. Is that correct?
Yeah, and we're, you know, retrofitting is what I always called a short-term chicken egg cracker. Our core partnership approach on the manufacturing and hardware side is to work with OEMs like Segway, other leading players in micromobility, so they can integrate our reference design, because all the electronics, the reason it's $100 is it's all commodity components. So we're not trying to, our business model is to not make money off of hardware. It's to empower as many OEMs as possible to build light electric vehicles and robots that come out of the factory compatible with our repositioning service. The core reference design, you know, we're using the exact same cameras that went into the scooter we deployed with GoX in the delivery cart. We're using the exact same processor, all the exact same firmware, effectively. So the repositioning works identically.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little more about the tech itself then? I mean, what can you share about that? It sounds like it is basically just, I mean, I'm not hearing any talk about any sort of super high-end stuff like LiDAR, sonar, radar, obviously, but I mean, it's all just camera-based, I guess?
Yeah, so two cameras, a laughably modest processor akin to what you would see on a, you know, Raspberry Pi grade, if you will, which you can use with our system. We do include a very cheap radar that is purely for detecting if something jumps right in front of you, just to default stop. That's also, you know, partially for future proofing for when we do want to use autonomy. That's not really as relevant in the purely teleoperated model. In the scooter space, scooters already come with IoT components, you know, data card, antenna, GPS that we need for what we do. So kind of the IoT module of a scooter plus two cameras plus a processor, and then, you know, in the scooter case, you want to add a motor for remote steering. But all totaled, we're not talking about more than $100 in electronics to make this possible.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool.
Huh. And so the, you know, a lot of the, you know, the craft and the IP is around video compression, so that you're, you know, managing latency effectively. You know, eventually that becomes a cost factor, because, you know, the three variable costs for us are going to be teleoperator labor, the mobile data costs, and the insurance costs. So we want to be efficient on that front. It's not, we're not trying to, kind of win accolades in terms of breakthrough R&D work. Our whole approach is technology like this has been working for over a decade inside our homes. It's the Roomba. We're now just, you know, upscaling it one level, but this is a lot more similar to a Roomba than it is to a self-driving car.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I can see that. Okay, cool. And I've really got to stop staring at this looping video, or it's never going to leave my brain. But I'm noticing there appears to be some sort of training wheels sort of things at the back of these. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's for the, so several of the manufacturers in the scooter space we're working with are actually going to be coming out with three-wheel scooters, where you don't need the retractable training wheels. For a two-wheel scooter, what we do is, instead of having the traditional kickstand on one side, we just replace that with retractable training wheels that when, and they actually end up lifting the back main wheel. So it's on three wheels when it's parked, or we're repositioning it. And so that provides us with the balance, but that's it's very unsophisticated. You know, that's about $10 in
hardware. If it works,
those training wheels. And again, for a rider, they're already used to the beginning and end of every trip, raising and then lowering the kickstand, and they're just doing that with their foot with these training wheels,
for sure,
as opposed to with the kickstand.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
How about connectivity? What I'm assuming that if it is in a remote drive mode, as it sounds like it is the vast majority of the time, I'm assuming if there's a loss of connectivity, then the thing just comes to a stop.
Exactly. But one of the things we do, you know, our only really pre-work before deploying in an area is mapping it for connectivity strength. When we then generate routes for our teleoperators, if there are any dead zones, we'll avoid routing into them. Also, you know, one of the nice things, especially in the scooter space, is the IoT is running when riders are on the scooter as well. And so we're able to constantly be updating our map of where you might have dead zones. One of our core accumulating advantages is on the routing side. And kind of generating better and better efficiency there. And that's really where we focus our, you know, if there's an ML aspect to what we do, it's more so on the routing than on the autonomy software itself. Cause our view is, you know, we are developing our own autonomy software, but ultimately what determines the percentage of autonomy relative to teleoperations is more how good you are at routing around areas where you're going to have to fall back to teleoperations versus anything else. So the routing ends up becoming very, very valuable.
Yeah. And this actually reminds me, so 2 days ago, I had a pretty awesome chat with James Wu over from deepmap.ai. And it just got me thinking, could you guys not theoretically also effectively kit these things out with the ability to accumulate all sorts of HD mapping data of your own also, which can be used either for yourselves or indeed effectively licensed to others, whether it's for autonomous vehicles generally or anything else besides? I mean, it seems to me like if you're gonna have all these scooters everywhere inside of cities, that offers a lot of potential for getting a ton of mapping data too.
Yeah, we're taking a very disciplined approach to not monetizing the data besides just making our service better and better, because when you put cameras on scooters, there's inherently privacy concerns that a city might have. And I think
there's no expectation of privacy in public streets generally.
Yeah, but it's just, we think it's important to position ourselves as like above reproach when it comes to even close to being on a gray area there. Cause I think cities, if they start perceiving our vehicles as surveillance cameras, or I think there's a lot of fears and doubts that might be raised if we're seen as a data reseller. And so we're just, who knows what down the road other business models we might consider, but for the time being, we're really focused on just purely monetizing the repositioning as a service. We're think of us as a moving company. You pay us per minute or per mile. And it's as simple as that. And I think one of the big challenges of bringing automation and autonomy to public rights of way is preserving and building trust with the regulators and public officials. And I think one of the things that erodes that trust is when companies are a little too cute about all of the potential ways they might monetize data, and effectively exclude cities from that. We're just focused on repositioning. We see that as a massive mm-hmm. opportunity. And if we just, I think many startups have made the mistake of trying to bite off more than they can chew. And I think for us, we just want to get really good at reliably repositioning things at low speeds.
Totally. And of course, there's a thing to be said about being super focused, because of course. But it also does remind me, I know that HERE Technologies actually works with cities insofar as sharing the data, kind of brokering the data back to cities insofar as assisting with road maintenance, for instance, right? So instead of sending human survey crews all over cities kind of at random to find bits of road that need repair, now all the data they're getting from the vehicles, whether it's suspension data or even camera data or whatever, this now can be sold to cities so they can just zero in on whatever needs to be fixed. Talk about getting on a city's good side with respect to data accumulation. I think that's probably a pretty good approach. I totally hear you. It makes sense to
And we've received requests like that. And our view is actually, if to the extent to which we'll be sharing those types of insights, we'll do it at mm-hmm. no charge. We see that as the price of being allowed to operate in a city, create value for the community. But in terms of the commercial focus, prioritize the repositioning.
Yeah. And with respect to your point about security or privacy generally, it reminded me, and I just Googled it to be sure. I remember I was in Germany back in October, and I learned that sentry mode on Teslas are indeed illegal in Germany for precisely that issue. You simply cannot have kind of ongoing video recording. I hear you. Huh. All right. All right. So let's see. With respect to connectivity generally, I'm curious. I know it's become a bit of a cliched question. Do you have any opinion either way on the importance or the necessity, I suppose, of 5G deployment generally? Like, because I feel like there's kind of two schools of thought. Some folks say, yeah, you really need a properly deployed 5G network to sort of facilitate every aspect of an autonomous future, including and especially, of course, vehicle to X communications generally. Certainly it's going to help for teleoperation, if only by virtue of, I guess, almost zero latency. At least I guess that's the promise, right? Do you have any strong opinion either way on its importance or significance?
Well, I think it's very important for supporting teleoperations for a large mass vehicle that's going 40 miles per hour or even 20 miles per hour. The reason we built Tortoise is we're not dependent on infrastructure scaling. And I think that the problem with 5G is not the technology, it's a real question of like, when will it actually be, as pervasive as 4G is today?
Well, right, because there's a huge range issue too, right? So you're going to need a lot more of these things.
Yeah, so if your service is dependent on 5G, then you're not going to have a very reliable service for a very long time.
True.
So I think that's the reason we're so excited about the low speed light mass opportunity is if you think about, you know, the latency we're dealing with, so say 100 milliseconds of latency, if you're only going five,
hey, that'll get you on Quake, man. That'll get you on Quake or Doom or whatever.
Yeah, it won't. You're talking about going a matter of inches. If you're going 5 miles per hour, if you're going 60 miles per hour, you're going to go like 10 feet. I think that's where we feel very comfortable at the low speed managing the latency the way we are. But if we were trying to go faster, that would absolutely start creating safety issues.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think the way we think about 5G is it will allow us to go faster in certain use cases. But if you're going the sidewalk, you're going to start freaking out pedestrians if you're going a lot faster than 5 miles per hour anyway. So there's a natural, yeah, I think more on the
bike. I get more freaked out just by bicyclists blowing past with 2 inches to spare.
Yeah. So I think that's, that's where this kind of all intersects with what we're doing at Tortoise. But I think it's risky for any startup to be building their service, assuming, you're going to have 5G because it's you'll have it in certain parts of cities in certain cities, but transportation doesn't work that well if you can't get everywhere.
Never mind the fact that you've got a bunch of folks convinced that 5G caused COVID, but never mind.
There will always be conspiracy theories, and the fresher the technology, the more ripe it is for that.
Exactly. So, with respect for your time, I guess I have two ish questions. I mean, you mentioned pedestrians on sidewalks, so I've got to ask the silly, totally stupid question, but it's kind of worth asking, honestly. I mean, come on, people are going to knock these things over. They are. I mean, people knock cows over, unfortunately. They're going to knock over autonomous scooters. What's the practical solution for this?
Yeah, so and this is, again, where having a teleoperator based solution is helpful, because one of the other components that is part of the $100 is a speaker. And so the teleoperator actually has...
start yelling at them.
Yeah, well, it's not... I mean, they have pre-recorded voice commands that they can, out of their interface. So if somebody's intentionally getting in the way of the scooter, they'll hear, hi, I'm trying to get to somebody who requested a ride. Can I help you? So there's a... there's a series of escalating voice commands that you can deploy. And what that also does is it reminds the person that might be doing the illegal or annoying thing that while, we're not in the business of sharing a video feed with public authorities, they are at some level being recorded. And it's not, in the scooter share 1.0 world, when you throw a scooter into the river, there's really no chance of you getting in trouble doing that. But there's a deterrence factor that with these things having cameras on them, I think will help us mitigate some of those issues. The other aspect to this is avoiding having scooters in areas where they're most likely to be vandalized. So, when it's last call in the part of town where there's bars, move all the scooters away from that area. Like you're just asking for trouble by having the scooters there in the first place. The reason the operators can't do that now is it's just really expensive to have people driving around in trucks and vans to move them to safer locations. So I think the combination of strategically rebalancing out of areas where you're more likely to have vandalism, and then using the voice commands and the inherent deterrence that comes from that also works in your favor.
You know, this totally just gave me an idea. I worked with a guy once at a previous startup whose brother had developed down in SLO, San Luis Obispo. Actually, it's worth asking. Do you know the town? Have you been there before?
I drive frequently between Bay Area and Southern California. So I've driven through it, but I haven't spent much time there.
Okay. Well, the point being that it's just geographically, it's worth trying to picture in your head. It's a pretty small, very dense little walkable kind of village of a town, right? And this guy actually developed probably, I don't know, it's 10 years ago or so. I don't know really how to call it, but it's basically like one of those big pedal bike things that can carry 10 or 12, 15 people, you know? Yep. And it was effectively like a post-party, sort of like a Uber bicycle thing for people who are too drunk to drive or even get their own Uber, for that matter. Actually, this was probably before even Uber got deployed there. But it just occurred to me, I mean, you mentioned not having these scooters around, you know, last call in bar areas. But on the flip side, gosh, I mean, theoretically, regulations permitting it at some point. Imagine you could do the same with remotely operated, transport for folks safely out of these bar zones too. And if it's not a scooter, perhaps less potential for obvious, easy vandalism.
Yeah, I mean, our technology doesn't really make sense when there's a rider on the vehicle, because nobody wants to go 5 miles per hour, right? So we're, you know.
Well, that's true.
And if in the middle of a repositioning, somebody hops on the scooter, we would just stop and use the voice commands. We're in the business of getting your transportation to you, but not moving people.
Yeah, no, of course, that makes sense. And I would imagine there's gotta be at least some non-trivial environmental impact too, to not requiring folks to like an actual, I remember I was in DC for instance, and I would see, and it's weirdly, I've never seen them anywhere else besides there, but I was just constantly seeing these scooter, like pickup vans with a team of two or three folks, pick up scooters, load them on the vans and shuttle them around. I'm sure there's gotta be some pretty interesting metrics on how much of a benefit there would be to eliminating the need to do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the benefit of shared scooters today is getting undone by then having to pay for people driving around in gas guzzling trucks and vans.
Exactly.
The other irony is very often to get the scooters, those trucks and vans end up temporarily parking in a way where they're blocking the bike lane. So they're, they end up creating a hazard. There's a lot of efficiency on the recharging side, but ultimately, and we see our kind of, as I stated at the outset, the three value props are the demand side, getting the right scooter to the right rider at the right time, the recharging savings, and kind of the VMT impact, and then the clutter impact, and depending on the market and the operator, different value props will matter more. But the one that we think is the most enduring is on the demand side, because eventually, I'm optimistic that batteries are getting better and better. And in 5 years, you could very well have a battery that will last you a week. And so that problem might start solving itself. Whereas the underutilization problem, that's eternal. The way I like to explain shared scooters today is, imagine if you're running the world's least efficient taxi service, what you would probably do is make it so your taxi drivers can only wait at the location of their last drop off to get their next pickup. And that's effectively what we have today with shared scooters and bikes. And so huge room for improvement by allowing that real time rebalancing.
No, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think this is a seriously, obviously, awesomely much needed solution to a thing. So I, for one, welcome the day we see these things buzzing about on their own. I guess to close it out, actually, feel free to share what are your kind of deployment plans going forward, either with respect to, I guess, certain cities, geographies generally, timeframes, partners with other scooter companies, anything you feel like sharing.
Yeah, well, I'll avoid making headlines today, but we will. Our next market after suburban Atlanta is going to be San Jose, California.
Cool.
So in our respective backyard here, in the delivery cart space, there's actually 10 states and the District of Columbia already have existing laws that allow the operation of delivery carts and robots on the sidewalk. So a lot of latitude there, and we're engaged with a lot of different communities about that. But we're seeing very strong receptiveness from cities worldwide, including in Europe, that all are plagued in the scooter space by the challenge of sidewalk clutter and obstruction. And so there's a very receptive audience to the solutions we're proposing.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, yeah, no, I'm definitely a fan. So, very cool. Dimitri, thanks very much. It's been awesome to finally sync up and chat about all this. I'm excited what you guys are doing. And, yeah, what can I say? I look forward to seeing these things on the road, pretty soon. I may have to head down to San Jose, it looks like, and, I look forward to check it out.
So thanks so much for having me on. Love the conversation. Always happy to come back.
Yeah, my pleasure. Exactly. Yeah. Feel free to circle back a couple months, catch up where you guys are at. Until then, take care. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, that is a wrap for today. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful rest of the week. I'll see you back here on Friday. Take care. Bye-bye.